Hi, I'm David Freudberg from Humankind. Occasionally on this podcast, we present classic programs from our archive, including the one you'll hear now from our series, Kindred Spirits. For that program, we sought out people of many backgrounds, traditions, and life experiences to understand the personal beliefs that give them purpose and animate their activities. If you like what you hear on this podcast, we're asking for your help to keep it going. Please visit humanmedia.org, and at the top of the homepage, click on How You Can Help. Thanks.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be
God,
with you. Allahu Akbar.
Our Father, who art in heaven,
ku soku ze shiki
jihi in te domine speravi non confundar in aeternum. In you, O Lord, I trust. May I never
Shema
be confounded.
Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad.
Walk cheerfully over the earth, answering that of God in every one.
You're listening to Kindred Spirits.
I'm David Freudberg. Our guest today is Dr. Viktor Frankl, author of Man's Search for Meaning, numerous other books, and founder of a school of psychology called Logotherapy. You've experienced some awful circumstances. You were imprisoned in Auschwitz by the Nazis because you're Jewish. I can imagine that for some people who were placed under such terrible conditions, they would have lost faith, lost hope, lost a sense of the universal perfection or the meaning hidden behind things.
Why?
And for others, there was some sustenance in that faith. And I wonder how it struck you at the time.
You see, there is a book. There is a book whose title was After Auschwitz. As far as I know, it was written by a rabbi, but I wonder if this rabbi is still to be regarded or is still regarded by other rabbis in your country as a rabbi. Anyway, the tenet of this book reads that after Auschwitz, it is no longer possible to believe in God. This, I think, is a great mistake. Because, as I see it, either belief is something unconditional, or it is no real belief at all. So, either you believe in God, then you must maintain this belief even in view of so and so many victims of the Holocaust. Or if you do not believe unconditionally in God, you would have to withdraw, to renounce your belief in God even in the face of one single child that suffers or dies innocently. And this, as you may remember, was a problem with which Dostoevsky was struggling. Anyway, what I'm heading toward is my contention that you cannot bargain enter any bargain with God. You cannot say, "Dear Lord, up to 600,000 victims of the Holocaust, I maintain my belief in thee. But if it's more than 600,000, if it's 6 million, I renounce my belief." This is impossible. And behold, generally, more people confronted with the tragedies of concentration camps, gas chambers, and so forth, more people were experienced a deepening of their religious feelings and experiences in view of all the tragedy than weakening of their religiosity. So the fact is that those who have been in Auschwitz, the majority of them did not renounce their belief in God after Auschwitz or in Auschwitz. This is the fact.
Did your faith deepen? And if so, why? What contained in that test, perhaps, in the horrible atrocity that you witnessed day after day, what contained in that could have deepened your faith? That's the question that so many people would ask.
A human being is a being in continuous search for meaning. And if such a human being is confronted with deep suffering, particularly looking at other people who are deeply suffering, then automatically, more or less automatically, if he is himself someone who is deep in his experiences, automatically, of course, he tries to see a meaning, to find a meaning, even in suffering, or let me say, to maintain his belief in a meaning of life that is so unconditional that it comprises and includes even the meaningfulness of suffering and the meaningfulness of death. Just remember the very deep and wonderful title selected by Elisabeth Kübler-Ross for one of her latest books, Death, the Final Stage of Growth. In other words, you may even grow even the last moment, up to the last moment. Even death may offer an opportunity to grow. All the more suffering. Because life is not only meaningful or can be found meaningful or made meaningful by what by your works, by your deeds, and beyond that, by your experiences, by experiencing something in the world or someone in his or her very uniqueness, that is to say, by loving him or her. But finally, also, as the helpless victim of a hopeless situation, say confronted with an incurable disease or an inoperable cancer, you may bear witness of the uniquely human potentiality to turn a tragedy into a personal triumph, to transform one's suffering into a human achievement. And if you are confronted with such a tragic situation, say in a concentration camp, an unavoidable and inescapable, literally inescapable, extreme situation, you ask yourself whether even this has some ultimate meaning, even if only a hidden meaning. But this is a general rule or even law, I would say. It is my contention that the more comprehensive a meaning is, the less comprehensible it is necessarily. In other words, the ultimate meaning can no longer be grasped in any intellectual or rational terms, but only in an act of personal faith, of personal belief. That is why I spoke of a belief in ultimate meaning. But this ultimate meaning must include the potential meaning of suffering and even of dying. And the as long as you are confronted with welfare and with affluence, such ideas may not come to your consciousness, to the surface. But precisely in such tragic situations, in the confrontation with such extreme situations, in the confrontation with pending death, facing unalterable suffering, the question crops up, has also this meaning. So there is nothing you can do about it. You just have to accept it. You have to face it. You have to allow these questions to come up in your, to surface in your consciousness. And this depends on the type of a one's personality. If you are used to see, to look at things as if they were transparent, transparent toward a metaphysical dimension, that you are not satisfied. If you are a deep type of a person, you are not satisfied with just scientific explanations, with just seeing in a human being the outcome of conditioning or learning processes or the product of unconscious psychodynamics. If you go deeper, if you delve into the essence of a human existence, then questions will come up in your consciousness that go beyond such simplistic explanations. And then you ask yourself the question, is there a meaning? Is there an ultimate meaning? Is there a meaning that even includes suffering and dying? And if so, then automatically the dialogue or monologue, however you interpret your soliloquies, takes place in yourself.
Was there a tendency in a place like Auschwitz to see it as some kind of a vast drama because it was so unreal in so many ways, so unlike what we normally think of as reality, and to sort of rise above it and see it as a great lesson for one's personal growth, for one's deepening of faith and understanding of meaning? Did you ever think of it that way?
Only afterwards, because you knew exactly that the chances to survive were very limited and small. I happen to know that the chances to survive the concentration camps only after entering Auschwitz, not to include the chances of dying before in other camps preceding Auschwitz, but only after October 1945, after I had spent more than 2 years already in other camps, the chances were only, the odds, only 1 to 29, according to the statistics I had seen. And so people generally didn't believe in their in chances to survive. But afterwards, of course, everybody had to learn a lesson from it. Someone having stood at the ramp of the railway station of Auschwitz in 1944 and still having been granted several decades of life and an opportunity to work and to do something, such a person, you will understand, is again and again asking himself whether he has been worthy of this grace to survive for so many years. And he can only become worthy by using each moment from that time on, each moment at the best of his conscience. And so you have to ask your this question, whether you have been worthy or not, incessantly. This is no pathological symptom. Unless you ask yourself this question, you are really not only not worthy of that grace, but you are not really a human being, because the essence of human existence, in a way, may be defined as responsibleness, as being responsible each moment, for each moment, not only for what you are doing, but also for what you are becoming, and being fully aware of this responsibleness.
I know that you made a very conscious conscientious effort while imprisoned in the death camp to be responsible, to choose on the side of human qualities rather than animal qualities, not to yield to the temptation to be reduced just to an animal because you were being treated as an animal. Could you describe the way in which one makes such choices under very difficult, adverse situations?
It's scarcely possible to describe such ways, not even in psychological terms. What I would have to say to this problem is just that education should see to it that people do not forget their own responsibilities, should see to it that educators should not confine their activities to transmitting knowledge, but also to see their principal assignment in refining the conscience, heightening the sense of responsibility in young individuals. And beyond that, making them aware of the fact that they are free to decisions. They have the capacity to decide. But actually, education on amounts to a large amount to indoctrination of young people on all the campuses and indoctrination of mentally suffering people on all the couches, analytical couches, in a sense of helplessness, of being a victim, of being a product. People are indoctrinated, are told, are taught that man is the product of inner or outer circumstances. Man is the victim of society, of sociological, biological, or psychological conditions. But man is not really a victim. Man is always a being who is capable of deciding what he will be himself in the next moment. Not only deciding what he will do in the next moment, but even what he will become in the next moment. Because what Thomas Aquinas once said, that agere sequitur esse, that is to say, one's deeds, one's acting corresponds and derives from one's being, from one's personality structure. This is true, but only half of the truth. I would add the complementary statement that not only what you are doing depends on what you are being, but also by what you are doing, you are becoming someone, one type or another type. In other words, your being depends on your acting, on how you are deciding what to do. By deciding what to do, you are also deciding what you become. And people should be this sense of responsibility, this sense of freedom should be stressed and emphasized, rather than preaching people that they are victims, that they are the product, the results, that they are really helpless, that is what makes them fatalistic. And even if you are speaking of freedom, you should be aware, remain aware, and make people aware that freedom itself is only half of the story, half of the truth, and needs being supplemented by the other half. Because freedom always threatens to degenerate into mere license and arbitrariness, unless it is lived in terms of responsibility. And that is why I so often recommend to American audiences of mine when lecturing in your country that they should supplement the Statue of Liberty on your East Coast by a Statue of Responsibility on your West Coast.
Where does the strength come from in facing a choice between yielding to the animal qualities and choosing the human qualities? How do you make that choice, and how do you find it in yourself to make such a choice?
Everybody can make such choices as long as or as soon as he is aware and becomes or has been been made conscious of alternatives. There is a desire in man, deep-seated desire in man, to find and see and fulfill a meaning in each life situation confronting him. Second, there is also a meaning in life, or a meaning behind life. He is not only yearning for meaning and searching this meaning, but there is a meaning also waiting for him to be fulfilled by him and exclusively by him, a special meaning waiting for each and every person in life, in each life situation, up to the last moment. So there is a will to meaning and there is a meaning in life. But finally, or primarily, there is also the freedom to choose the fulfillment of meaning, the freedom of decision to decide, yes, I would like to find a meaning in life, I have found a meaning in life, and now I'm going to fulfill this meaning because I have the freedom to do so, and if more, I feel the distinct responsibility to do so. Now, when you view things that way, there is no question where do you get the strength. You see, strength, all this is such a physicalistically oriented concept. You don't mean it that way, but it comes down to that way. And as if I talk to a patient and say, now it depends, you know what you should do, but of course it depends on the strength, whether you also possess the strength to do so. At that moment, I yield him arguments, alibis, because he will retort, yes, doctor, but I simply don't have the strength. Could you kindly give me the strength? Could you hand out a prescription, so and so many ounces of strength? You see, it becomes so materialistic. At the moment you see something clearly, you have a vision, and no indoctrinators are inhibiting and impairing this vision, this natural vision, inherent and dormant in each individual. Then, at the moment you have the vision of a possibility, then you are automatically, as it were, you go on and fulfill it. To perceive meaning, as I see it, means that you are confronted with a real situation, with a given reality, and against its background, against its reality as a background, you suddenly perceive a possibility that is the possibility to do something about the reality, to change the reality, to transform the reality, to make it into something better. You have found the meaning to transform the reality into something better, be it biologically or psychologically or even sociologically or politically. But there are situations in which you cannot transform the reality. There are situations, for instance, in which you are confronted with an unchangeable fate. There exist situations in which you cannot do anything about it, except for changing yourself. By changing yourself, you may mature, you may grow, you may rise beyond yourself and rise above yourself.
How did your experience in Auschwitz help you grow? How did you grow and mature through those awful times?
Frankly speaking, I did not reflect about it, and generally, I hate reflecting about something like this. I wrestled with the situation inwardly until I found a meaning even in that situation, and I just, when I was close to, near to despair, I gave myself admonitions. For instance, I told myself, you are so desperate about having lost your spiritual child, your book manuscript, without any chances to survive this situation. Now, have you ever pondered the question, what would the meaning of life be like? What a poor sort of meaning would it be if it depends on whether one has published a manuscript or not? Life must have a deeper meaning than that. And so I had to reconcile myself. Or in another situation, I well remember when people around me lying in the barrack asked themselves whether all this suffering and dying can have any meaning at all. And my reaction was, either life has an unconditional meaning, and that is a meaning that even includes suffering and dying, or I wouldn't find life worthy of surviving at all, because a life whose meaning depends on whether I survive a camp or not, such a life would not be really worthy of being lived. So you have to radicalize the question of meaning. You know what I mean? You have to push forward until you arrive at the recognition that there is an ultimate, and this means an unconditional meaning in life. So each individual has a chance to find a meaning, and of course to fulfill the meaning, and has the freedom to decide to make the option for rather than against the opportunity to fulfill the meaning.
Thank you very, very much. Talking with Dr. Viktor Frankl, author of Man's Search for Meaning and founder of Logotherapy. From Vienna, Austria, I'm David Freudberg.
Kindred Spirits is produced by David Freudberg and Public Media Foundation, with production assistance from Lee Ellen Morvin. Theme music by Russ Barenberg and Alan Byrne. Studio recording at WGBH Boston. Cassette tapes of this program are available for $9.95 each, prepaid. To order cassettes, or if you have questions or comments, write to Kindred Spirits, Post Office Box 777, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02139. That's Kindred Spirits, Post Office Box 777, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02139. Our special thanks to the Satellite Program Development Fund at NPR, the Permanent Charity Fund of Boston, the Campbell and Hall Charity Fund, and stations WGBH, WNYC, and WFCR, whose generous support made Kindred Spirits possible. Thank you very much for listening, and may the spirit of unity bring you peace.
To hear more episodes of Humankind, you can subscribe to our free podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your preferred podcast player. A new episode each week. The podcast title is Humankind on Public Radio. And if you enjoy this program, be sure to leave us a kind review at iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to support the program, please visit humanmedia.org. And at the top of the homepage, click on How You Can Help. Again, our web address is humanmedia.org. Thanks.